Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves. And I have a pretty exciting guest today. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this. I'm being joined by Joni McEwen, who is sort of one of the founders of the Pyrenean Shepherd here in the United States. And as she just was telling me, wrote the original breed standard and has been very actively involved with this breed since before it was recognized by the American Kennel Club in 2009. So welcome, Joni. I'm super excited to have you join us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's going to be fun. Now, we were just talking off air. You, and I know a lot of the people who own this call them Pure Sheps, right? The Pyrenean Shepherd.
Yes.
We were just looking this up, 181 of 193. So you guys, in terms of numbers, registered with the American Kennel Club.
Yes, we're definitely a low entry breed for sure.
Right. Absolutely. And I actually saw one this weekend, which out here on the West Coast is rare. So I was like, wow, look, perfect timing. So give us the 411. How did you get wrapped up in dogs and how did you find your way to the Pure Shep?
Well, I started, you know, beyond just owning dogs, I started showing and breeding dogs in the 80s with an Australian Shepherd. And at that time, they were quite unusual. They were not AKC recognized. And even outside of that world, there weren't a lot of them. So got my feet wet in that and spent a lot of years actively showing and then eventually became a judge and was very successful with that. And then around, I guess, about 2000, a kennel club that I was on the board of, we were having somebody come and share about an interesting breed that most of us had not seen, which was the Pyrenean Shepherd. So that was my first exposure, and I was really intrigued about the breed and their smaller size and just how intelligent they were. And they're also one of the breeds that are behind the Australian Shepherd, it's believed.
Oh, interesting. I had not heard that. Huh.
Yeah, there's some old photos and some historical yearbooks for the Aussies that have pictures of some Blue Merle Pyrenean Shepherds. So it's believed that they're behind them. If you look at the smooth face ones, it's much easier to imagine. Sometimes the rough face, people kind of get a quizzical look because they just they look so different. Of course, there were lots of other breeds behind that too. So anyway, I was just fascinated with the breed, got in touch with one of the main breeders in the United States. There were not a lot of breeders in the U.S. and Canada, and started visiting and learning about the breed and eventually ended up judging the breed. I judge Australian Shepherds, which I did not say, I don't believe. And so just really kind of fell in love with the dogs and ended up getting one. And that was the rest is history, I guess. So I just really fell in love with them and love the small, compact size, but yet they're really intelligent and like to go do things.
So give us some information about the background. I mean, this is, to me, a breed that's still something of a mystery. Like, I've seen a few, and then that's about it. This is why this was so cool, because most of the breeds I have followed along or I've learned about them as they've come in, but to me, this is one that's still just an absolute enigma. So tell us all about them.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have not even met them. So they're not that common, as we just heard the numbers. I think one of the most important things to understanding the breed is understanding where they came from. And when people contact me, sometimes interested in getting one, that's the first thing that I always talk to them about. Most people are familiar with the Great Pyrenees, big white dogs that are livestock guardians. So the Pyrenean Shepherd, which in France and in Canada also are known as the Berger de Pyrénées. So they would work in tandem with the Great Pyrenees. So the Great Pyrenees would do the guarding and the Pyrenean Shepherd would do the herding. So most herding breeds are larger because they have to play a dual role of both guardian and herder. So like an Australian Shepherd would be an example of that, right? So they've got to be able to take on challenges that come along. They've got to be big enough to do that. So because the Great Pyrenees did the guarding, the shepherds could keep the Pyrenean shepherds smaller, which meant they could keep more dogs, which meant they could keep more sheep. So it was really important. The Pyrenees Mountains, sometimes when people think of herding dogs, they think of, you know, the rolling hills of Scotland and the border collie working in an open field.
Mm-hmm.
Our minds just kind of go there. But this breed, knowing where they come from, just explains so much about their personality and their temperament. So the Pyrenees Mountains in France, they are very, I would say they're more like our Rocky Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're very challenging environment, you know, lots of sharp cliffs and things. I mean, it's not a place that you would imagine even livestock being.
Right.
So a lot of the shepherds, they were more on the poor side. And so they would, in the summertime, take their flocks up in the mountains and they would graze all summer. And then the winter they would have to come back down because it's too difficult to stay up there. So they needed a big guard dog because there were bears and wolves and other very dangerous things there. The eagles that are there are big enough to carry lambs off. They're really quite large.
Wow.
So they needed a really strong presence in the big dog, but having the herding dogs be smaller, as I said, they could keep more sheep. But still, because of the small size of the Pyrenean Shepherd, they also were in that dangerous environment and they needed a certain type of temperament. So not only the herding instinct to do their job, but they also needed to be wary and suspicious of anything different. Because if you're that small and you're in that environment, you could end up lunch
for
somebody.
Right.
If you're curious, you know, and just like, oh, what's that? Let's go. So by nature, they are very suspicious of anything new. And that's a really important key thing, I think, to understand about the breed. So that was a good quality for the shepherds because it meant that those dogs were going to stay alive to do their job.
Right.
They needed that to happen. They couldn't work without the dogs. So having that, you know, you wanted a dog that was just attached to you, that was not going to be curious and go off exploring something new, that they were going to raise an alarm if something unusual happened. That was really, really useful to the shepherd. One of the things in this breed where it can be a little bit problematic, and even when they first came into AKC, were just doing agility, is they got a little bit of a bad reputation for being fearful and having bad temperaments.
Right.
So that was not completely inaccurate. There were dogs that were fearful.
Yeah, I saw a couple of them.
Yeah, and with bad temperaments. And I think part of the problem is of course, we're not in that environment. Most of us aren't herding for a living with our dogs.
Right.
But there are people, and sometimes even people breeding the dogs, that don't understand the difference between fearful and suspicious.
Right.
So in those mountains, in that really rugged, tough environment, being suspicious kept you alive so you could do your job. Being fearful would not be useful to a shepherd. It would mean you're going to panic and probably run the sheep off of a cliff, which is not what they wanted happening. So understanding that, and I like to have that conversation, as I said, when people call, because they need to appreciate that. One of the other things about the Pyrenees Mountains is that it's very, very isolated, even today. And more so in years past, but you can drive miles and miles and miles down these gorges and windy roads and just go a long way to get to the end of a valley. So that resulted in each valley having, there were many different types within the breed too, which we can talk a little bit later more about when we talk about the structure of the dogs.
Right.
But so being in an isolated place means you have limited genetic material, which means these guys are pretty hardwired to be suspicious. The breed standard says they're naturally distrustful of strangers. Again, that doesn't translate into they should not be fearful of strangers.
Right.
They should just go, if you're not on my friend list, I'm not sure I'm going to trust you because I don't know you yet.
They're not friending everybody on Facebook is what you're saying.
No, they're not. They're not. You know, and in another part of the breed standard, it says that they're passionately attached to their owners and to the complete exclusion of others. And, you know, I just heard the other day an exhibitor, a judge kind of got after them because the dog was being real standoffish and they fussed at the exhibitor and said, this is supposed to be a family dog. They don't need to act like that. And I'm thinking you didn't read the breed standard.
Right, exactly.
Because the appropriate temperament for this breed is to initially not be fearful, but to have that mistrust. Now, we can socialize a lot. And if you go to France, these dogs are not going to come up to see if you'll pet them. Most American dogs, they will. If people come to my house, they're probably going to be mobbed by the dogs. Who's going to get petted first? But that's a result of socializing. But people do need to appreciate at the core, this breed is hardwired to be in that environment and do that job, which was so necessary, which means they can be really challenging to grow up. And breeders and owners can make a lot of mistakes because there are some dogs that do just have poor temperaments.
Right, that just go to the other end, right?
Right, which should not be bred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those
exactly.
dogs help to have a happy, normal life. But those traits will pass on. So I think it's something as breeders that we have to be really careful about. But as owners, too, to understand that this is not going to be a breed that is just going to naturally, without a lot of work, love everybody that mm-hmm. they come in contact with, including dogs that go to shows all the time and they can do their thing there, but doesn't mean they want to be best friends.
Right. And I think that what you're talking about is so, so valuable. And we talk about this a lot on the show, the importance of preservation breeding and understanding, you know, when people acquire a dog, understanding exactly what the dog is and why it is the way it is, right? Like
right.
German wire hair
yeah.
pointers kill cats because that was what right. they were bred to do.
Right, exactly. And why is the terrier digging up the backyard, right?
Like exactly. Exactly. Like, hello, that's what they were bred to do. And why is your beagle running off after the... Well, that's what it was bred to do.
Right.
And I think that that is one of the most important things that we as preservation breeders can do for the public, for our puppy buyers, is to help people understand the importance of learning the history and the traits of the breeds that you might be interested in order to get the best fit for your family.
Exactly, exactly. And to the comment that the judge made about being a family dog, mm-hmm. being a family dog doesn't translate because these dogs are usually incredibly devoted.
You are not a member of my family, sir.
That's exactly it. And they will make that very clear distinction. Mm-hmm. One story I always like to tell people because it shows a lot, I think, about the breed. Mm. When I was first learning about the breed and I was going and visiting breeder, and there was one particular dog, and, you know, I was there on and off over a couple of years, and the dog wanted nothing to do with me at all. Wasn't afraid of me. There was nothing I was going to do to get that dog to come to me. Mm. And then one day I showed up. Dog ran over, jumped in my lap. I had made it to the friend list. And every time I saw that dog, it could be long periods of time in between that I didn't see it. And it was, we were best friends. Mm. This breed sees the world in a very black and white way. You are friend or foe. There's not a lot of gray area for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that has really wonderful qualities and really challenging qualities too.
Right.
You know, they can learn to expand that gray area, but it is so important. You know, as you said, preserving that heritage. I mean, the French mm-hmm. judges, we try often to have French judges come to our national, and they will often fuss at us about how friendly our dogs are because they do not consider it to be appropriate breed temperament. Now,
right.
some of that is, of course, as with any breed, we kind of live in a world where we need our dogs to be a little friendlier. And so there's
yeah.
kind of this drift away from traditional temperament because we want that dog that just anybody can walk up to it and pet
mm-hmm.
it. And so it is really important because when we lose those pieces, we're losing genetics too.
Yeah.
If we start kind of drifting, you know, and turning a Pyrenean Shepherd into a Golden Retriever, well, that's not what it was. There's nothing wrong with being a Golden Retriever, but it's a really different temperament, and we can't expect to have that across the board.
I love it. Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. So talk to us a little bit with all of this understanding, this is great. Talk to us now. The part that always fascinates me is the rough face and the smooth face. It just completely, because the body coat's basically the same, right?
It's not really the same. And there's even more divisions than you just said, of course.
Oh, dear.
The breakdown is the smooth face and the rough face. And in Europe, in France, and in other countries in Europe, they actually have a completely separate breed standard. When we were going into AKC, they don't allow varieties anymore unless you want to just have a separate breed, which we don't even have the numbers to even consider doing that. So we had to kind of blend it together. And the smooth face and the rough face even have different head structure. Their body length is different. I mean, they're quite different and they can be born in the same litter. You know, apparently some of those traits just transfer together because there really are differences in that. So a smooth face has a shorter coat. Those coats are never going to cord at all. They're not unsimilar to a light-coated Aussie. They don't have all that undercoat, but pretty easy to manage. Then the rough face has two coat types within it. So there's a long-coated dog and a demi-long dog. So a demi-long dog has kind of a shorter coat like a smooth face, but they still have the long hairs on their face. So if it's got any long hairs on its face, it's a rough face.
Okay.
So sometimes it can be even difficult with those dogs when they're puppies telling which way they're going to go.
Right.
And then the long-coated dogs have more coat and typically, if left to do so, will end up with cords on their body. So they will get them on the back half of their body and also a little bit on the chest and the front legs, never on the front half of the body and never on the head. It's the only breed, I believe, that doesn't have, you know, there are other corded breeds, of course, but they have it all over their body. So they're kind of unique. The coat, I mean, you can almost see a line down their back. It's really interesting that the coat is just really different.
And so when they're shown, are they shown corded? What is the grooming required? I mean, literally, I think I've seen six of these dogs in my life. So this is all absolutely fascinating.
If you go to France, all the adult dogs are going to be corded. That's just traditional, and it's very rustic. The coat type that this breed has, it doesn't have a spiral to it, so you're not going to get those beautiful kind of rounded cords that you're going to see on some other breeds because their coat texture isn't just like that. And different dogs can even have different types of cords. Some of them are kind of like flat tiles. Some of them are a little bit more round. In the U.S., you don't see that many people courting their dogs. People are a little intimidated by that. Some of the judges get a little fussy about it because they think you didn't groom your dog.
Right.
Because they're never going to look like some of the other corded breeds. They're not supposed to. They're supposed to look like this dog is up in the mountains working. That doesn't translate into dirty and uncared for, but it is a very rustic look. So you don't see so many. So if you can keep them brushed out, starting the cords out can be a little tricky sometimes because they're basically kind of little mats.
And
you have to split them a little bit to get them. And then once they get longer, they're really not that much maintenance at all. They kind of take care of themselves. I love the traditional look with the cords. So most of my dogs usually have them, but most Americans do not cord their dogs.
And in the ring, is there any preference?
There should not be any preference. Our breed standard allows them to be corded or not corded. I think because some of the judges kind of don't know what to do with it. I mean, I actually had a judge say to me, and this was a few years ago, so, you know, they said, I really loved your dog, but I couldn't use it because it has cords and it's not allowed. And I said, can we pull the breed standard out, please? And this was
after
the show. And, you know, use it for an educational moment. But I think it's really important that there are people out showing corded dogs because I think it's important for the judges to see them. But there shouldn't be any preference one over the other. But that doesn't necessarily translate into what happens.
Right.
And I think most of the dogs, even that are brushed out, end up being way over groomed. And the French judges would have a fit if they saw what they look like.
So what does over grooming look like for a pure Shep? That's a whole nother question and conversation. What does that look like?
Yeah, so this is a breed that really should not have their coat washed that often because it kind of softens it. The coat is described in the standard as being kind of halfway between a sheep and goat hair. So if you've ever touched a goat or a sheep,
that's interesting.
it has a very coarse texture to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there shouldn't be a lot of bathing, no blow drying. As far as trimming goes, the breed standard is very, very clear about it. In fact, it has strong penalties. The bottom of their feet may be trimmed, just kind of neaten their feet up. And there should be never any trimming to the face. And that is really, really important because one of the unique characteristics, they have kind of a unique head, and the rough face are described as having a windblown look. So the hair should start out very short on the muzzle, and as it goes back, they get longer and longer. So it gets this beautiful windblown look. There should not be a lot of coat hanging over the eyes. The dog should look like it could go out and function without turning into a giant mat in the field. But you don't want people trimming to create that, which of course you can do. So there shouldn't be, the judges should highly penalize anybody that they think has been trimming the body in any way, and in particular the head, because it's such a unique characteristic of the breed that it can be lost easily. I mean, it just happens that you can end up with too much coat, and you have to be careful even with breeding with that. And so the French were occasionally crossing in the smooth faces, so it kind of kept a balance a little bit.
Okay.
So you can get into, just like any other breed, there's things, again, that can kind of drift in a direction. So no trimming. The dog should not look like it just got
barbered
to go in the ring.
Right,
yeah,
right,
no, not
right.
at all. So, and we have a little bit of a challenge with our breed standard. We allow, so traditionally the tail's docked and the ears are cropped.
Mm-hmm.
Most European countries now, it's against the law to do those things. So they had to kind of change their standard to accommodate that. When we wrote ours, we wrote it so that both are acceptable. But, you know, in France, once they allowed the full ears, they did allow some neatening up around the ear, which is important because it is a breed that can get mats.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, we don't have that built into our standard because we allow both. So that would be something that, just for the sake of the dog, that I personally would say, you know, let's keep the dog
health purposes. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Okay. So here's a breed that, for someone who's looking for a dog that's low maintenance grooming, that's a good size, you know, in terms of manageable size, that is aloof with strangers, this is a very, very interesting breed. So who makes a great owner? Like, who is your ideal, you would be a perfect owner for the Parian Shepherd?
I think a really, really important thing is there has to be some activity going on in their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that's you just walk and hike a lot, or you do agility, or you do herding or something. They really, really need a job. Also, this breed is really, really brilliant. Almost frightening sometimes, the things that they figure out.
You're like, understand, yes.
How did you figure that out? So they are not always the best breed for a novice dog owner.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, somebody that is experienced with dogs, understands dog behavior and how dogs think and behave. And there's a lot of things. And of course, having another herding breed in the past, like, you know, it's kind of a common thing to say with herding breeds, they're very intelligent, they need leadership, they need something to do. But this breed is probably more intense than most of the other herding breeds that I've owned or been around. And some of it is they're a little closer to the roots, right?
Right.
So an Australian Shepherd today is really different even than when I started in the 80s, the temperament.
Right.
You know, it's just, they're just softer and easier to live with. They don't have a job so much. So, and that just works better in our culture. So this is a breed that they almost have the intelligence of a wild animal that has to survive, right? Like most wild animals are brilliant because if they're not, they're weeded out of the gene pool.
Right. And how long back does this breed go? Do we have any sense of that?
We don't really know. There's a lot of different theories. There are people that have said that they have found some skeletons in caves from thousands and thousands of years ago that are similar in shape. Certainly, they've been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I think most of the breeds, you know, the Great Pyrenees, of course, and the Pyrenean Shepherd are the French version. Spain has its big white guard dog, and it's small herding dog. Like most countries in Europe where there is a mountainous culture, especially where you take the sheep up in the mountains, you know, most of those breeds are really, really, they have ancient roots. I mean, they just,
they've been around forever. Commodore and Puli and all of that.
Yeah. You know, if you look at a map of Europe and you follow where those mountain ranges, you're going to have that. They call it a transhumance, where they would go up in the mountains in the summer and then come back down. So that is a traditional lifestyle that no one really does anymore, but that can be found all through Europe. And almost all those countries have their big white dog and their smaller herding dog of some form. So they've been around for a really long time. And of course, there's no way to fully
pin it down. Right.
Yeah. The breed in France, you know, and of course they were kind of in an isolated area, so the rest of the world didn't know about them necessarily. Probably the first time that they got the world's attention a little bit is in World War One. They used them for messenger dogs because they're very fast, they're very agile, they're super smart. And so they use them for a lot. There was a lot of loss to the population because of that, unfortunately, too. So in the 20s was when a group of people there really developed the breed standard and started making a very focused, beyond these dogs were just getting bred to do a job, that there was, you know, focused attention to preserving the breed. And because of all those different valleys had their own types and different looks. I mean, they're really, some of them are really different. And that's one thing that the American judges really struggle with, in addition to the fact that we have all these coat types and sizes. Like, it's a pretty complicated breed standard. But one of the other things, and the French still really value this, is historically those specific different types. So even when you have a litter, like if I have an Aussie litter, sometimes they end up coming out, they're like cookie cutters, right? They might be different colors, but they're very, the Prenian Shepherds, I mean, you really just, you could get almost anything because there's so many different looks behind them. And those genes are all still there. So when you look in the ring, sometimes you can look at them and you see judges even doing it like, which one is what
which one is
like?
Right?
And the answer is all of them.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So here's a great question. So you have a ring full of Prenian Shepherds and they all look different. Which one is right? How do you decide that as a judge? What makes this one better than that one?
Well, that's where all those different styles of dogs, they're still all going to fit in the description of the breed standard. So the general structure should be the same, the style and the look, which is probably going to be a lot with coat and everything. Even fitting within what the breed standard says, that can look pretty different. But those dogs, the head is really a distinctive characteristic. The movement is so important because, as with all herding breeds, the dogs needed to go out and do their job. They need to be able to work all day. And this breed has kind of a unique movement. The French call this shaves the earth. Like, there's very little lifting of their feet off the ground, but they can just keep going and going and be efficient.
The ones I've seen almost like shuffling. Like, they just don't lift their feet at all.
Yeah, there shouldn't be a lot of lift off the ground, but they should be covering a lot of ground at the same time. Because, again, up in the mountains, and when you're that little, you're going to have to move twice as many steps as, you know, a German Shepherd. You know, size-wise. So they needed to be able to go. And so for me, and this is just a personal thing for me as a judge with any herding breed, sometimes when you get down to those stylistic things, and we all even have preferences of what style we like better than the other, but those dogs should always look, and this is to me true of any herding breed, they should look like whatever their job was, because every herding breed has a really different job. They should look like they could get out there and they could just do that all day long. And the Prenian Shepherd is kind of cute. And people find them, and, you know, pet people come in shows, are kind of wandering around. Everybody just like adores them and thinks they're so cute. They have very mischievous kind of, they have funny sense of humor and they've got a really cute little head. But, you know, this is a working dog. And so it should not just be a pretty face. It needs to be able to go do what it's supposed to do.
Excellent. And pretty long lived, pretty healthy, or?
Yeah, this breed can live to be 17 to 20 years old. So they're they're really long lived. It's interesting because many herding breeds have a lot of eye issues and there are some eye issues in the breed, but mostly a lot of herding breeds share similar issues because they kind of all come from similar backgrounds. So because the Prenian Shepherd was pretty isolated, there's not so many eye issues. And the ones that we do have are most of the time really not debilitating to the dog.
Right.
Hip dysplasia, interestingly, is an issue in the breed, although most of the dogs you would never know. And in Europe, they feel like if the dog could do their job, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure that would go that far.
Right. That functionally dysplastic, we see it actually usually in more Lumber Spaniels for years. They would just think of them that way. They're doing the job. Yeah. It doesn't matter what the hip conformation is.
Right. Yeah. And people are sometimes surprised if they see them wet down because there's not much to them underneath their coat.
Right.
They don't have a lot of muscle. They're very lithe and lean. They shouldn't have extra weight on them. And so they're not putting a lot of physical stress on their hips sometimes. Now, that doesn't mean that it should be ignored because I think it's just important that we need to pay attention. And there's a few other health issues, but in general, most of the health issues that we have in this breed, you're going to find when they're little puppies,
right?
Which is great from a breeder point of view, as opposed to having big scary things that show up later. But they are very long lived. They will be there in your life for a while.
I like that. Okay. All right. Well, Joni, thank you so very much for sharing about this breed. It is fascinating. And I love it. And I will have you send us pictures and anything that we can so that we can educate our listeners.
That would be wonderful. I really enjoyed this too.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.